Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to this podcast for January 14th, 2021. We are broadcasting this week from the Quadrennial Department here at the Georgia Historical Society. Next week, we will have a presidential inauguration, the 59th in our country's history, and we're going to talk about the history of this event and how it's changed over time, beginning with the very first one in 1789. We'll talk about when they're held, where they're held, why there is 2 months between the election and the event itself, and some of the historical oddities and anomalies associated with this august occasion over the last 232 years since the very first one. But before we get into that, however, let's begin with a look at the ever-popular This Week in History. On January 14th, 1940, 81 years ago, civil rights leader Julian Bond was born in Nashville, Tennessee. Bond graduated from a Quaker school in Pennsylvania and came to Atlanta to attend Morehouse College. Bond led nonviolent protests that helped integrate Atlanta lunch counters, theaters, and parks. In 1960, he was one of the founders of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and began organizing voter drives throughout the South. In 1965, Bond was elected to the Georgia State House of Representatives. The lawmakers refused to seat him because of his outspoken opposition to the Vietnam War. His district reelected him 3 times, and the legislature banned him every time. In December 1966, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the ban unconstitutional, and Julian Bond took his seat. He served 20 years in the state legislature in both the House and the Senate. In 1971, he helped found the Southern Poverty Law Center in Montgomery, Alabama, and served as its first president for nearly a decade. In 1986, he ran unsuccessfully for Congress in a hard-fought contest against fellow civil rights veteran John Lewis. From 1998 to 2010, he was chairman of the NAACP. If you've ever watched Eyes on the Prize, the award-winning documentary about the civil rights movement, you've heard Julian Bond's wonderful voice as he served as narrator. Julian Bond died on August 15, 2015, at the age of 75, and his ashes were scattered in the Gulf of Mexico. On January 15, 1929, 92 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr., born as Michael King Jr., was born in Atlanta. The religious and civil rights leader came to fame through his leadership during the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955 and 56, and rose to national prominence as head of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. King was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964 following the historic March on Washington in August 1963. Dr. King was assassinated in Memphis on April 4, 1968. He was first buried in Southview Cemetery in Atlanta before his reburial in 1970 at the Martin Luther King Jr. Center at the MLK National Historical Park in Atlanta. In 1983, after a long campaign, the federal government established Martin Luther King Jr. Day to be celebrated annually on the third Monday in January. It was celebrated for the first time 35 years ago in 1986. On January 16, 1871, 150 years ago, Jefferson Franklin Long, the first African-American elected to Congress from Georgia, took the oath of office in the United States House of Representatives during Reconstruction. Long was born a slave in Alabama in 1836. His owner sold him to a man in Macon, where Long taught himself to read and write while setting type for the Macon newspaper. Long attended Macon's African Methodist Episcopal Church and was deeply influenced by Henry McNeil Turner, one of Georgia's most prominent African American leaders during Reconstruction, and a Republican Party organizer. Long became an active Republican and helped elect 32 African Americans to the Georgia State Legislature in 1867. In December 1870, Long won a special election and became the state's first black congressman. He went on to become the first African-American to speak on the floor of the House of Representatives when he opposed an amnesty bill for former Confederates. White supremacy ended Reconstruction and black political participation. Georgia wouldn't have another black congressman until Andrew Young in 1972, and of course Georgia would not elect a black United States senator until the election of Raphael Warnock on January 5, 2021. Jefferson Franklin Long, the trailblazing African-American congressman, died in Macon on February 4, 1901, at the age of 64, and is buried in Macon's Linwood Cemetery. On January 17, 1706, 315 years ago, Benjamin Franklin was born in Boston, Massachusetts. Franklin became renowned as an American printer and publisher, author, inventor, scientist, and diplomat. One of the foremost thinkers of the era of the Enlightenment, as well as one of the foremost of America's founding fathers, Franklin helped draft the Declaration of Independence and was one of its signers in 1776. He represented the United States in France during the American Revolution and was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention in 1787. Franklin was not only the most famous American in the 18th century, he was also one of the most famous figures in the Western world. Indeed, he is one of the most celebrated and influential Americans who has ever lived. His autobiography was published in 1794, and if you've never read it, you should. In addition to his lightning rod and his Franklin stove, he invented bifocal glasses, the odometer, and the glass armonica. He had ideas about everything, from the nature of the Gulf Stream to the cause of the common cold. He suggested the notions of matching grants and daylight saving time. He helped to establish new institutions that people now take for granted: a fire company, a library, an insurance company, an educational academy, and a hospital. Franklin died in Philadelphia on April 17, 1790, at age 84, and an estimated 20,000 people attended his funeral and burial in Christ Church Burial Ground in Philadelphia. Franklin bequeathed 1,000 pounds, about $4,400 at the time, each, 1,000 pounds each, to the cities of Boston and Philadelphia in trust to gather interest for 200 years. By 1990, 200 years later, more than $2 million had accumulated in Franklin's Philadelphia Trust, which had loaned the money to local residents. When the trust came due, Philadelphia decided to spend it on scholarship for local high school students. Franklin's Boston Trust Fund accumulated almost $5 million during the same time. There's a new book out by historian Edward Larson entitled Franklin and Washington, The Founding Partnership, published in 2020 by William Morrow. Check it out. On January 18, 1904, 117 years ago, Archibald Alexander Leach was born in Bristol, England. To escape poverty and a dysfunctional family, Archie Leach ran away from home at age 13 to perform as a juggler with a troupe of comedians and acrobats. He frequently worked in music halls in London, where he acquired a Cockney accent. Leach made the United States his home during the company's American tour of 1920. His performances throughout the country in numerous stage musicals and comedies during the late 1920s and early 30s led to a contract with Paramount Pictures in 1932. Studio executives thought Archie Leach was an unsuitable name for a leading man, and they rechristened him Cary Grant, a name he would legally adopt in 1941. Grant established a screen persona of debonair charm and was widely regarded as one of the handsomest men in film history. Adding to his appeal was his unique speaking voice. His not wholly successful efforts to rid himself of his natural Cockney accent resulted in a clipped, much imitated speaking pattern. His screen success was in no small measure assured by the great number of classic films in which he appeared and the great directors with which he worked, including Alfred Hitchcock, some of the best work either of them ever did. My favorite Cary Grant film is 1948's Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House. If you've never seen it, find it online and watch it. The Cary Grant persona was too much even for him to live up to. He famously said, "Everyone wants to be Cary Grant. Even I want to be Cary Grant." There's a new biography by Scott Eyman entitled Cary Grant, A Brilliant Disguise, published last year by Simon & Schuster, that I commend to you. Cary Grant died on November 29, 1986, at age 82. He was cremated and his ashes scattered in the Pacific Ocean. On January 19, 1861, 160 years ago, Georgia seceded from the United States, the fifth state to do so, leading directly to civil war. Georgia's decision had far-reaching and unintended consequences for all Georgians and indeed for all Southerners. The secession movement began after Abraham Lincoln's election in November 1860, 2 months earlier, in the belief that his Republican Party was aggressively anti-slavery. As the largest and most populous Deep South state, Georgia was crucial to the success of the secessionist movement. Georgia's secession convention was almost evenly divided between immediate secessionists and those opposed, who thought Lincoln hadn't done anything provocative except win an election. Heated debate led to an overwhelming pro-secession vote, 208 to 89. Georgia's Declaration of Causes made it clear that the defense of slavery was the primary cause for dissolving the Union. Future Confederate Vice President Alexander Stephens, who counseled patience, warned that the decision would lead to war. Secession did bring war, and ultimately the end of slavery, ironically making Georgia's secessionist the most practical abolitionist of all. And finally, on January 20th, 1937, 84 years ago, Franklin Delano Roosevelt was inaugurated for his second term. And every 4 years since then, we've had a presidential inauguration on that date, which leads us directly to this week's topic. And that's This Week in History. And now to this week's program. Next week, on January 20th at noon, a new president will be inaugurated in Washington, and this is a time-honored tradition that goes back to the very earliest days of our nation's founding. The Constitutional Convention met in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787, and in creating the United States government, they created the office of president, the nation's chief executive. The Constitution was signed on September 17th and submitted to the states for ratification. The new government would not go into effect until 9 states minimum had ratified, but of course the founders wanted unanimous approval by all of the 12 states that had attended the convention and hoped for the eventual approval of the one that didn't, Rhode Island. And of course, North Carolina and Rhode Island were the last two to approve the Constitution, to ratify. On June 21, 1788, the minimum of 9 states was reached, and the first presidential election was held in December 1788 and January 1789. George Washington was elected unanimously by the Electoral College. The federal government began operations under the new form of government on March 4, 1789, which would be used as the date of all future presidential inaugurations from 1792 to 1933 for 141 years. Though Washington's term officially began on March 4th, he was not sworn in for 8 weeks while Congress waited on a quorum. He was finally inaugurated as the nation's first president on Thursday, April 30th, 1789, on the balcony of Federal Hall in New York City, the first capital of the new government. We've grown accustomed to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court administering the oath, but the oath was administered to Washington by Robert R. Livingston, the Chancellor of New York, that is, the highest judicial officer of the state of New York. At Washington's second inaugural on March 4, 1792, the oath was administered by Associate Justice William Cushing. Chief Justices began administering the oath in 1797 when John Adams, the second president, was sworn in by Chief Justice Oliver Ellsworth. Now, Federal Hall in New York, where Washington was inaugurated, was at 26 Wall Street in what is now the heart of Manhattan's financial district. That building was demolished in 1812, and the current building on that site was completed in 1842. The site is now named Federal Hall National Memorial, and there's a statue of Washington on the site where he took the oath. As an aside, I should tell you, on September 6, 2002, approximately 300 members of the United States Congress traveled from Washington, D.C. to New York to convene in Federal Hall National Memorial as a symbolic show of support for New York, still recovering from the September 11th attacks. The meeting was held just 4 blocks from the former World Trade Center's Twin Towers and was the first meeting of Congress in New York since 1790, 212 years earlier. Now, the only thing the Constitution says must happen is that the president must take the oath of office. And Washington did this using a copy of the King James Bible that was printed in 1767. At Washington's inaugural, the Bible was held by Samuel Otis, the Secretary of the Senate. Now, we've seen in later years, of course, the Bible is held often by a member of the president's family. For Washington, it was held by the Secretary of the Senate, and it was a Bible owned by the Masonic Lodge of St. John's Masons No. 1, which was fetched when they discovered that no other Bible had been provided. It was opened randomly to the 49th chapter of Genesis. The Bible was not used at any other inauguration for 132 years until the inauguration of Warren G. Harding in 1921. It was used again by Dwight Eisenhower in 1953, Jimmy Carter in 1977, and George H.W. Bush in 1989, which of course was the bicentennial of Washington's first inaugural. George W. Bush intended to use it, but the weather was bad on January 20, 2001, so it remained in the Capitol. The Bible is now usually on display in Federal Hall National Memorial, built on the site of Washington's inauguration, as I mentioned. Incidentally, Barack Obama placed his hand on the Lincoln Bible for his oaths in 2009 and 2013, as did, coincidentally, Donald Trump in 2017. Though the first inauguration was on April 30th, as I mentioned, all subsequent inaugurations from Washington's second inaugural in 1793 to Franklin Roosevelt's first in 1933 were held on March 4th, the date on which the federal government came into existence in 1789. With the passage of the 20th Amendment in 1933, the president's term begins on January 20th at noon. The date was moved up because in the 18th and 19th centuries, it took longer, of course, to count and report ballots after the presidential election. So there was 4 months in between, and because of the winter's logistical issues in moving to the Capitol. With improvements in transportation and the passage of the 20th Amendment, presidential inaugurations were moved forward to noon on January 20th, thereby allowing presidents to start their duties sooner, but still having time to put together a new administration. Incoming presidents now have anywhere from 72 to 78 days to put together their administration during this transition period. The number of days, of course, depends on when the election is held. It must be held the first Tuesday after November 1st, so it can be held anywhere from November 2nd to November 8th. And this has been in place since 1845. The only exceptions to presidential inaugurations on either March 4th or January 20th, besides, of course, death in office, which we'll talk about in a moment, was those years in which March 4th fell on a Sunday. Now, when it did, the public inauguration ceremony would take place on Monday, March 5th. This happened on 4 occasions. At James Monroe's second inaugural in 1821, Zachary Taylor's inaugural in 1849, Rutherford B. Hayes in 1877, and Woodrow Wilson's second inaugural in 1917. Following ratification of the 20th Amendment to the Constitution that moved the date to January 20th, there had been 3 occasions when the public ceremony got moved to Monday, January 21st. Dwight Eisenhower's second inaugural in 1957, Ronald Reagan's second in 1985, and Barack Obama's second in 2013. The only part of the inaugural ceremony that is mandated by the Constitution is reciting the presidential oath. It is not required that it be administered by the Chief Justice, but it usually is. Since 1789, the oath has been administered at 58 scheduled public inaugurations by 15 Chief Justices, one Associate Justice, I mentioned that in 1792, and one New York State Judge, that is Robert R. Livingston at Washington's first. Now, other people, in addition to the Chief Justice, have administered the oath of office. In addition to the scheduled public inaugurations that we've been talking about following an election, there have been 9 so-called non-scheduled extraordinary inaugurations in American history, as they're called, following either a president's death, assassination, or resignation. The first non-scheduled extraordinary inauguration to take place in American history was that of John Tyler, William Henry Harrison's vice president. in 1841. Harrison was the first president to die in office in 1841, and 2 days later, Tyler was sworn in by William Cranch, Chief Judge of the United States Circuit Court of the District of Columbia at the Brown's Indian Queen Hotel in Washington, D.C. The second non-scheduled extraordinary inauguration was that of Millard Fillmore, who became the 13th president when Zachary Taylor died in July 1850. Fillmore took the oath in the chamber of the House of Representatives inside the U.S. Capitol the day after Taylor's death. Like Tyler, Fillmore took the oath administered by William Cranch of the U.S. Circuit Court of the District of Columbia. Andrew Johnson was sworn in by Chief Justice Salmon Chase at the Kirkwood House Hotel in Washington, D.C., following the assassination of President Abraham Lincoln in 1865. In 1881, Vice President Chester Alan Arthur took the oath in his private home in New York City, following the death of President James Garfield the evening before. It marked the first inaugural in New York City since Washington's first in 1789, 92 years earlier. 2 days later, Arthur repeated the oath before Chief Justice Morrison Waite at the U.S. Capitol in Washington. Theodore Roosevelt became president following William McKinley's assassination. He became president on Saturday, September 14, 1901, at the Ansley Wilcox House in Buffalo, New York. The oath was administered by John R. Hazel, U.S. District Judge for the Western District of New York. Now, one of the most famous, Calvin Coolidge, was visiting the family homestead in Plymouth Notch, Vermont, when he got word of President Harding's death on Friday, August 3, 1923. Coolidge was sworn in by his father, John Calvin Coolidge Sr., who was a Vermont notary public and justice of the peace. 18 days later, on Tuesday, August 21st, Coolidge repeated the oath before Justice Adolph Holing Jr., of the Court of the District of Columbia at the Willard Hotel in Washington. Vice President Harry Truman was famously at the U.S. Capitol when he received an urgent call on Thursday, April 12, 1945, to come to the White House, where he was told that President Franklin Roosevelt was dead. Truman took the oath at 7 p.m. that evening in the Cabinet Room inside the White House. Chief Justice Harlan Stone administered the oath of office. Stone began the oath, "Do you, Harry Ship Truman," in the erroneous belief that Ship was the president's mother's maiden name, and by extension, was Harry Truman's middle name. And of course, Truman, the S didn't stand for anything. Truman replied, "I, Harry S. Truman," before the oath was continued. This was the second presidential inauguration in 1945 after the regularly scheduled inauguration for Roosevelt's fourth term on January 20th. This event has the distinction of being the first extraordinary inauguration to be photographed. Theodore Roosevelt had ejected the photographers from his 1901 inauguration after they started fighting with each other, and Calvin Coolidge's 1923 inauguration was late at night with no press or electric lighting in his father's house. The next extraordinary inauguration was Lyndon Johnson's following the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. He was famously photographed aboard Air Force One at Love Field in Dallas as he was sworn in by longtime friend Sarah T. Hughes, a federal district judge. This was the first and only time that a woman has administered the presidential oath of office and was the only time it was administered on an airplane. Instead of the usual Bible, Johnson was sworn in on a Catholic Missal, a book which contains instructions and text for following Mass throughout the year that had been found on a side table in Kennedy's Air Force One bedroom. And finally, the last non-scheduled extraordinary inauguration to take place was Gerald Ford's on Friday, August 9, 1974, in the East Room of the White House following President Nixon's resignation. Although this was the ninth of the, again, so-called non-scheduled extraordinary inauguration to take place since the presidency was established in 1789, it was the first to take place due to a president's resignation. The previous eight, as we've noted here, had followed the president's death in office. Ford had become vice president only 8 months earlier after Spiro Agnew resigned due to bribery allegations while he was serving as both Baltimore County executive and then later governor of Maryland. Gerald Ford was the first vice president appointed under the terms of the 25th Amendment. When he succeeded Nixon, Ford became the first and remains the only person to have held both the office of vice president and president without having been elected to either. Now, since the 1981 inauguration of Ronald Reagan, the ceremony has been held at the west front of the United States Capitol, facing the National Mall and the Washington Monument and Lincoln Memorial. Before that, from 1829 to 1977, most inaugural ceremonies took place on a platform over the steps at the Capitol's east portico. They've also been held inside the old Senate chamber, the chamber of the House of Representatives, and the Capitol Rotunda. The most recent regularly scheduled inauguration that didn't take place at the Capitol was the fourth inauguration of Franklin Roosevelt in 1945, which was held at the White House. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Washington's first inaugural was at Federal Hall in New York City, while his second in 1793 and John Adams' one and only in 1797 were held at Congress Hall in Philadelphia. Most presidential inaugurations since 1801 have been held in Washington at the Capitol building. The location for James Monroe's 1817 swearing-in for his first term was moved to the old brick Capitol in Washington due to ongoing restoration work at the Capitol following British destruction of the Capitol in the War of 1812. Now, the old brick Capitol served as the Capitol from 1815 to 1819. That building was demolished in 1929 and is now the site of the current Supreme Court building. Three other inaugurations, Franklin Roosevelt's fourth in 1945, as I mentioned, Harry Truman's first in 1945, and Gerald Ford's in 1974, were held at the White House. Andrew Jackson's first inaugural in 1829 was the first of 35 held on the east front of the Capitol. Since the 1981 first inauguration of Ronald Reagan, they have been held on the Capitol's west front, a move designed to both cut cost and to provide more space for spectators. If you've seen these, you know, above the west front inaugural platform are five large United States flags. The current 50-star flag is displayed in the center. On either side are earlier variations of the national flag. Two are the official flag adopted by Congress after the admission to the Union of the new president's home state, whatever that is, and two are the 13-star flag, popularly known as the Betsy Ross flag. Scheduled presidential inaugurations have traditionally been outdoor public ceremonies, but they have moved inside because of bad weather twice. The first was in 1909 at William Howard Taft's inaugural. Now, this was still when it was on March 4th. 10 inches of snow fell on D.C. the night before, so the inauguration was moved indoors into the Senate chamber. The presidential oath of office was administered by Chief Justice Melville Fuller, who performed the duty for his sixth and final time. The new president, Taft, took his oath on a century-old Bible belonging to the Supreme Court, which he used again in 1921 to take his oath as the Chief Justice of the United States, of course, the only president who then became Chief Justice, and he then administered the oath to Herbert Hoover in 1929. Despite the weather conditions, the inaugural parade was not canceled in 1909. 6,000 city workers used 500 wagons to remove 58,000 tons of snow to clean the parade route. For the first time in inauguration history, the incoming First Lady, in this case Helen Taft, joined her husband in leading the parade from the Capitol to the White House. An inaugural ball that evening was held at the Pension Building and was the last official inaugural ball until 1949, as the next president, Woodrow Wilson, asked the city of Washington not to hold it. The tradition of inaugural balls was revived in 1949 as part of the second inauguration of Harry Truman. Incidentally, Truman's 1949 inaugural was the first to be televised. The second time, and you may remember this, the second time a scheduled inaugural was moved indoors was at Ronald Reagan's second in 1985. The temperature outside that morning, Monday morning in Washington, D.C., was 7 degrees with wind chills at minus 25 below zero. The inaugural parade, he was instead inaugurated in the Capitol Rotunda. The inaugural parade was canceled in 1985. Now, finally, it has been a tradition since 1797, when George Washington's second term ended, for the outgoing president, if possible, to attend the inaugural of his successor. As you know, the current occupant of the White House has announced that he will not be attending the inauguration on January 20th. Richard Nixon, of course, did not attend Gerald Ford's swearing-in, having resigned the presidency and had already left the White House. There have been five other occasions when the outgoing president did not attend, almost always when a one-term president has lost his bid for a second term. The first and most famous was John Adams in 1801, who left Washington, D.C. at 4 o'clock in the morning on the morning of March 4th on the northbound stagecoach and did not attend Thomas Jefferson's inaugural. The two friends who had labored together to forge American independence had become bitter political rivals during Washington's term with the formation of the Federalist and Republican parties, and their friendship had been severed in the contest of 1800. Adams refused to attend the ceremony. 28 years later, his son John Quincy Adams followed in his father's footsteps in 1829 when he left D.C. the day before his rival Andrew Jackson was sworn in. Many sources say that in 1841, Martin Van Buren, also a one-term president, did not attend the inaugural of his successor, William Henry Harrison. But I can't find definitive proof of that. His son was very ill at that time, and Van Buren, if he did miss it, may have been with his son instead. Van Buren did, in fact, move out of the White House the day before the inauguration, but he stayed in D.C., and in fact, we know he visited William Henry Harrison in the White House on March 11th, a week after the inaugural. Andrew Johnson bitterly despised incoming President Ulysses S. Grant, and he held a cabinet meeting in the White House right up to the moment of Grant's 1869 inaugural at the Capitol rather than attend. In fact, Grant drove to the White House that morning and sat in his carriage waiting for Johnson to join him for the drive to the Capitol together, according to custom, and Johnson simply refused to come out of the White House. Grant finally left without him after the snub, and Johnson did not attend. In 1921, Woodrow Wilson, having finished two terms, was present for Warren Harding's inaugural, but because of his ill health, having suffered a stroke in his second term, he stayed inside the Capitol during the ceremony rather than going outside for the event. This year will mark the first time in 152 years that an outgoing president will not be at the Capitol for the inauguration of his successor. So since 1789, there have been 58 inaugural ceremonies to mark the commencement of a new four-year term of a president of the United States, and an additional nine marking the start of a partial presidential term following the intra-term death or resignation of an incumbent president. With the 2021 inauguration, the oath will have been taken 76 different times by 45 people. This numerical discrepancy, of course, results chiefly from the fact that either a president must take the oath at the beginning of each term of office, and because the day of the inauguration, as I mentioned, has sometimes fallen on a Sunday, five presidents have taken the oath privately before the public inaugural ceremonies. In addition, three have repeated the oath as a precaution against potential later constitutional challenges when somebody muffed part of the oath. You may remember this happened between John Roberts and Barack Obama in 2009. There is no requirement that any book, or in particular a book of sacred text, be used to administer the oath, and none is mentioned in the Constitution. By convention, incoming presidents raise their right hand and place the left on a Bible or other book while taking the oath of office. While most have, John Quincy Adams did not use a Bible when taking the oath in 1825. He put his hands on a book of laws. Neither did Theodore Roosevelt in 1901. In 1853, Franklin Pierce affirmed the oath rather than swear it, which the Constitution allows. As I mentioned, a Catholic missal was used for Lyndon Johnson's 1963 swearing-in ceremony. And for those counting, Chief Justice John Marshall has the record, having administered the oath at nine inaugural ceremonies to five different presidents between 1801 and 1833. So, as you watch the inauguration on January 20th, I think it's important to remember that what you are seeing represents continuity with the very earliest days of our country's founding. That this ceremony has been reenacted every 4 years, and sometimes in between, by every president from George Washington onward. And that whether we support a particular president's politics or not, the inauguration of a new president and the passage of power from one person or one party to another by means of the ballot was something new in the world when it began in 1789. At its core, The inauguration of the President of the United States is still the best testament to the rest of the world of the enduring legacy of the belief that people can govern themselves, that they can freely elect their leaders, and that we, the people, have been abiding by the results of free and fair elections, with one tragic exception, since 1788. As presidents come and presidents go, it truly is a testament that we are a nation of laws and not of men. The hardest working engineer in show business, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS beard and mustache team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our GHS director of media manipulation and free elections is Patty, may you live so long, Maher. The GHS playground director, staff archaeologist, and fearless food taster is Elise, are you going to eat that, Butler. Our GHS coordinator of classroom indoctrination is Lisa War Eagle Landers. The GHS maven of social media and library science is Sabrina Human Search Engine Saturday. Our GHS efficiency expert and controller of German names is Karen Bodenschatz-Zollner. The director of the GHS Russian Literature Division is Christy Maple Crisp, assisted by our writing intern, Warren Pease. Our Off the Eaton Path fact checker is Ella Fino. Our staff holiday wardrobe consultant is Don Wienow. Our GHS French child care coordinator is Gerard Diaperdude. Our GHS Elvis impersonator is Amal Shookup. Our staff vote counter is Emmanuel Recount. And our Off the Eaten Path martini mixer is Olive Twist. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone and on Spotify. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure and like Off the Deaton Path on Facebook and Instagram as well. Please also visit deatonpath.georgiahistory.com and check out dispatches from Off the Deaton Path, my blog, and similarly oath-worthy podcasts like this one. Stay safe, stay strong. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening.